animus. On the animus point, does your suspect classification argument depend upon both showings, animus and targeting of a particular group?
I think if you look at the suspect class analysis and apply the factors that the Supreme Court has outlined, that's one part of the analysis. Is this a group that has been subject to a history of discrimination and the other factors so that laws targeting them should be treated as suspect? That's one piece. And the second piece is, as the Court has said, does that appear to be what is going on in this statute such that heightened scrutiny is warranted because, in fact, the statute is directed against the particular group? And so we think that that's how those two pieces of the analysis fit together. And looking at the legislative record, starting with the name of the statute, Defense of Marriage Act, it's a defense against something, and that something was same-sex couples. Furthermore, I think there's clear evidence in the legislative record of animus, including prejudice and stereotype-based thinking. The record, the House report, reflects an overt moral disapproval of homosexuality. That's a quote. Shows a repeated desire to avoid a stamp of approval on a relationship that many people think is immoral. And those same considerations infect the discussion of the other interests that Congress actually identified. So we think that this is a classic situation where you have a law that is targeting a particularly disfavored group, and therefore it should be subject to the kind of heightened scrutiny analysis that focuses on the actual legislative purposes as opposed to potential interests that are hypothesized after the fact for purposes of litigation, and that looks closely at the fit between the means the statute employs and the asserted ends, really to make sure that there's a substantial relationship between the law and an important governmental objective. And the point, as the Court has said in several of its heightened scrutiny cases, including Croson and the Mississippi University for Women case and Cleburne, is to smoke out illegitimate prejudice and to make sure that the law has a legitimate purpose and is appropriately tailored.
What is now, it you're asking the panel to do? If you listen to Mr. Clement, his suggestion is that you're not arguing a lack of rational basis and that you concede that we have a governing precedent that says rational basis is the test in these cases. Yet when I look at your brief, it seems to be saying that we ought to reverse the panel, ought to reverse the district court. Do you think you could draw these strands together and tell us what you actually want us to do?
Certainly, Your Honor. I think the Department's position is that the most common way for dealing with the situation would be for the court to take the case en banc so that it could address the heightened scrutiny analysis on the merits. Obviously, if there are other procedures within the court that it would allow the panel to accomplish that through other means, then obviously we defer to the court on that point. But the judgment that the President and the Attorney General have made is that heightened scrutiny is the appropriate standard precisely because rational basis would permit and arguably even require the court to disregard the facts of what actually happened, what was actually motivating the statute, and the reality of the history of discrimination against this particular group. So the determination and the position of the Department is that rational basis analysis is inappropriate in this circumstance and doesn't fit. But to be clear, Your Honor, the direction from the President and the Attorney General has been that the Department will cease defending Section 3 of DOMA on any basis. So I'm not here to defend it under any standard. The point is that we think heightened scrutiny is the appropriate standard and that's what should be applied.
Did you have a position on what would happen if we used the rational basis test?
We don't, Your Honor. We don't. And I think if you look at the interests that the Congress actually identified in supporting the statute, it's clear that they are either inappropriate, on their terms, or even if an important governmental interest in the abstract so disconnected from the statute that they can't justify what the statute has done. So one rationale that Congress identified was defending traditional notions of morality, which the Supreme Court has said cannot justify laws directed against gay and lesbian people. That's reflected in Lawrence, among other things. And it's also clear that a bare desire to harm an unpopular group is not a legitimate interest. So we think the law can't be sustained on that basis. Mr. Clement talked about defending traditional notions of marriage and related to that, the issue of child rearing, which is how the issue is teed up in the House report. And that's a situation where obviously the government recognizes that creating a stable environment for procreation and child rearing is an important governmental interest. In fact, that's why many of the statutes that are at issue in the particular claims in these cases are structured the way they are in some ways to facilitate stable environments for child rearing. But there's no basis to believe that the same-sex couples who are actually married under state law, which is the case for the plaintiffs here, are less than fully capable parents. And leading medical, psychological, and social welfare organizations, based on many studies, conclude that children who are raised in such families are just as likely to be well-adjusted and successful as children raised by straight parents. And it's for that basis that the department disavowed defense of the statute on this rationale even before the decision by the President and the Attorney General. But even taking that argument on its own terms, Section 3 is both over and under inclusive, because the federal government does not require an intent or even the ability to procreate on the part of a married couple in order to be eligible for federal benefits. A straight couple who marries for reasons other than procreation, has no intent or potentially ability to have children, gets the benefits regardless, whereas under this statute, same-sex couples don't. And then on the flip side, there are many children, hundreds of thousands, I think, is the best estimate, who are being raised by same-sex parents in this country. And DOMA has the effect of denying those children the stability and protection that many of the federal benefits that we're talking about in these cases would provide. So we don't think that DOMA has any with whether children will be born to couples who are actually married, the accidental conception situation that Mr. Clement hypothesized, or have straight parents raise their children. Denying federal benefits to already married same-sex couples will have nothing, really no effect on that at all. Similarly, I have a sort of a premise and an operational answer on traditional marriage as well. Yes.
Before we go too far, you indicated that you view that Cook is prior precedent that it should be applied by us, and therefore we should go to an in-bank court. If this case were decided on 10th Amendment grounds, would that also apply?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe that there was a 10th Amendment. Whether children will be born to couples who are actually married. No, Your Honor. I don't believe that there was a 10th Amendment issue at all.
Oh, you don't believe it, but I'm posing a question to you.
Yeah, no, there was no 10th Amendment issue in Cook, and so I don't think that case speaks to the 10th Amendment claims.
You going to cover the 10th Amendment?
Yes, I'm happy to do that, Your Honor. As I've indicated already, the Department's position is that Section 3 violates the equal protection principles. But we don't think that the 10th Amendment or the spending clause provide an independent basis for invalidating the statute. The 10th Amendment reservation of authority to the states is not applicable where Congress exercises its authority under an enumerated power under Article 1.
What is the enumerated power here if it's not the spending clause?
It is the spending clause for, as Mr. Clement indicated, for and potentially others, but certainly the spending clause for the programs that are at issue in this particular case.
That would depend on whether there's a equal protection violation or not. So we're kind of going around.
On the spending clause issue, that's certainly true. And so to the extent the court concludes that the equal protection principle is violated, then the result on the spending clause should follow. Under South Dakota versus Dole, the last restriction on Congress's spending clause authority is that it can't violate an independent requirement of the Constitution. So that would be the same result. The Tenth Amendment claim that the Commonwealth is making, as I understand it, is somewhat different. And I think that they're asserting that regardless of the equal protection outcome, there's some sort of separate Tenth Amendment basis for invalidating the statute. And that's where we disagree.
Tell me why.
As I indicated, where Congress is acting under an Article I enumerated power, the Tenth Amendment reservation of authority to the states is simply not applicable. Here, Section 3 defines federal benefits and obligations, we say, in ways that violate the Equal Protection Clause, but if you put that aside, it's a definition of the scope of a federal program. It doesn't displace state domestic relations law of any kind, including marriage, and I think it's well established that Congress has the authority to define the meaning and scope of federal programs. Congress may choose to borrow.
It has also always, as I remember, relied on state First of all, I start with the idea that this is domestic relations. There's a whole line of cases, which I'm sure you're familiar with, that hold that to be within the province of the states, the legislature, under the dual sovereignty theory. And it seems to me, and there's also cases holding that marriage is central to domestic relations. So isn't that the point here?
I think, Your Honor, certainly there is a tradition of Congress borrowing from state law definitions relating to marriage and other similar domestic relations matters.
Is there any case where they haven't done that?
Well, so as we cite in our brief, there are some statutes that on their own terms, federal statutes, that on their own terms have definitions of some of these terms. Those are not the majority, obviously, and agree with what was said before, that DOMA is unusual in that respect.
There's no other statute in which there's a general definition covering all the federal gamut of statutes such as this one.
That's true, Your Honor, and we think that is highly relevant for the equal protection analysis because, among other things, the departure from the state law norms in a way that targets a particular group, as this one does, and a suspect class at that, is a reason to confirm what's evidence on the face of the legislative history, which was that this law was motivated to out of disapproval of same-sex couples. But I think there isn't an independent Tenth Amendment problem with Congress, even if it hasn't used that power before, or very much, or in the general run of cases has incorporated state law definitions to actually define for the federal government the meaning of federal programs. And so I think the contrary proposition would be really a remarkable inversion of the ordinary principles of federalism and what the Supremacy Clause requires. So again, this is separate from the equal protection analysis, and to some extent, the fact that what this statute does is a departure from the norm is relevant to the equal protection inquiry. We think it's highly significant.
So while we were heading back to equal protection, what would be the principal cases, putting Cook aside without going into great detail, if you're not locked on, that you'd rely on for the heightened scrutiny standard, the principal Supreme Court cases?
Yeah, I think it's a series of cases a series of cases outline the factors that should be considered. And, you know, Cleburne is perhaps the most recent that outlines what the four factors are. History of discrimination, which we think is profound.
Are you relying on Romer? Are you relying on Lawrence?
Both of those cases are relevant to key points in the inquiry. So, for example, a number of the past Court of Appeals cases, and there haven't actually been decisions actually examining the factors as applied to same-sex or sexual orientation in more than 20 years.
Finish your answer.
Okay. Those cases all relied on, the ones that we're aware of, relied on Bowers and similar, and the now rejected rationale of Bowers that was rejected in Lawrence. Lawrence also rejected a distinction between status and conduct with respect to sexual orientation. And so it's relevant for those propositions, but we don't think the Supreme Court has ever confronted whether sexual orientation is a suspect class. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Donna's ban on federal recognition of my client's marriages violates the equal protection guarantee regardless of what level of scrutiny is applied. Of course, we agree with the Department of Justice that made the arguments ourselves that heightened scrutiny applies. But in any event, DOMA fails rational basis review because it does not further any legitimate federal interest. To this day, the federal government defers to state marital status determinations where marital status is a factor for federal protections. But for DOMA, same-sex couples who began marrying here 8 years ago, like our plaintiffs, would have been included in those federal laws. But DOMA's precise point was to prevent that conclusion and created an across-the-board exclusion. The promise of equal protection is that likes are supposed to be treated alike. And certainly, as Romer suggests, when it comes to the rights of persons, the Constitution demands neutrality. Yet in 1996, Congress jettisoned a neutral rule that has been in place for over 200 years and created a one-time exception only for gay people's marriages to deny them protection across the board. And it's significant to note.
Mr. Clement's argument was that the background conditions changed because of the Hawaii Supreme Court decision, and that alone justified a break with Congress's prior determination that it did not need a federal definition. It seems to me you need to reply to that.
Happily, Your Honor, for the entire history of our country, the one constant about marriage law has been change. Change that's been passionately contested between states and at times the federal government even weighing in about whether it wanted to advance a constitutional amendment. But nonetheless, the federal government has consistently maintained deference to the states, and including on interracial marriage. Before the Civil War, Massachusetts jettisoned its interracial marriage ban. In 1948, when California became the first state to declare such a ban unconstitutional, there were still 30 states that had them. But all through this time, the federal government neither weighed in for nor against. It simply deferred to state determinations. So the central question, as we see it in this case, is what federal interest is served by singling out only the marriages of same-sex couples for this across-the-board disrespect? And with respect, our view is that the efforts to conjure a rational basis fail at the threshold. Blag mentioned the family-related rationales, and I would just say that responsible procreation and optimal child-rearing are not furthered by DOMA, even if they, you know, no matter what one might think about what is the best parent. And I say that because DOMA does one thing only. What it does is single out married same-sex couples for disrespect, including those who have children. It offers no new protections or encouragement to heterosexual couples to marry or have their children in a marriage. There's no supports for different-sex parents in DOMA. It is simply an exclusion. In the same vein, another predicate of rational basis review that we believe Blag fails here is justifications for a classification must be independent and legitimate from the classification itself. So let's take uniformity, for example. It's a perfect example of collapsing means and ends. any rule that treats one group alike, of course, accomplishes uniformity with respect to that group. But the legal question is, what is the justification for singling out that group for different treatment? What is the basis, the principal legal basis for the different treatment? And that carries over to other arguments made in Blagg's brief about the public fisc. Of course, it saves money to deny benefits. Again, the question is, why single out this one group for cost-cutting, equally among married couples? It would clearly save money to deny benefits to redheads in marriage, of course. But what's the legitimate basis for doing so? And that's the question that Blagg doesn't answer. Turning to the issues around caution and status quo and the allegedly unique environment of 1996 and preserving legislative judgments for that matter, these two fail. They fail on the preserving judgments, they fail because all that Blagg is suggesting is that the Congress wanted to maintain an exclusion now that state laws have changed. The reason that the federal government didn't have benefits and protections and obligations going to same-sex couples before was because state law did not authorize it. But when state law changed, that federal government changed its rule, and again, only for same-sex couples. As to caution and status quo, I also want to say that, as Judge Toro ruled, that those are a means to an end. When there's some sort of problem to be addressed sometimes, that it makes sense to hold back or freeze something for some period of time, but there's not any suggestion that there's any problem here. There's no problem that's being solved by DOMA. It is simply that, frankly, the Congress just did not want to deal with married same-sex couples. And I would note that all we're talking about here, and all I hear Blagg saying is, it's a problem because same-sex couples were marrying. But again, they were marrying, and more people marrying, and contests in state marriage eligibility rules have happened over time. It was just more people marrying. I also want to agree with the Department of Justice that I think Blagg has an anemic view of rational basis review here, and even the cases it cites in its memos acknowledge a difference between ordinary public welfare laws and those that directly burden a class. Schweiker, for example, says it's entirely different if a law subjects a discrete group to subordinate treatment. Vance says it's only absent some reason to infer antipathy that courts stay their hands when Congress draws a line. This burden was direct. It was not a mere consequence of some other larger goal. The whole purpose of DOMA was to ensure that same-sex couples, when they married, would not be treated like other married couples under federal law. And that's almost a quote from the House report. So the record is clear that Congress did not want to treat same-sex couples like others. And with Section 3 of DOMA, Congress added the seventh of what are now eight definitions in the Dictionary Act, which is essentially posting a no married gays need apply sign over the entire United States Code. That makes this case like Romer and Cleburne and Moreno. And like Amendment 2 in Romer, that forbade only gay people from bringing claims of discrimination, DOMA puts married same-sex couples in a solitary class, inflicting a broad range of harms, not just monetary harms, and this is not a spending case, but essentially making married gay people unequal to everyone else because they are same-sex couples and not for any other purpose. You've already heard, and I won't repeat, what Congress said at the time in 1996, but I think it's clear that the efforts to conjure a rational basis here can't evade the central flaws from what Congress was doing in 1996, expressing its disapproval of same-sex couples marrying and disagreement with state law decisions to marry. But again, disagreement with state law decisions to marry is a consequence of dual federalism, where states marry people and the federal government does not. And as to moral disapproval, I want to particularly note the amici brief of members of Congress, which frankly acknowledged that in 1996, with Bowers versus Hardwick still being good law, that Bowers essentially invited lawmakers to express their moral disapproval of gay people, and that false stereotypes and reflexive bias were rampant and dominated both the public and the private debate. So, Your Honors, we believe that DOMA is an irrational, arbitrary classification of gay people for its own sake and not for any other purpose. And we would ask you to affirm the district court in Gill and reverse as Tahara.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning. Maura Healy on behalf of the Commonwealth. May it please the court. I'd like to focus by offering the state's perspective on some core principles at issue in this case. Who in this courtroom today had parents whose marriage license was not recognized under federal law? Whose parents had a marriage license that made them sort of married? That were subject to a definition that made them not married for all purposes? The Defense of Marriage Act is revolutionary. It takes away from Massachusetts a single unitary marital status that is valid for all purposes. And it requires us to live with two distinct and two unequal forms of marriage. This is not a burden visited on other states, or at least states that don't extend marriage to same-sex couples. This is a burden that Congress has imposed on Massachusetts simply because it doesn't like the fact that gay people are getting married. It's also extraordinary, not because alone this is the first time that the federal government has sought to do this. It's extraordinary because defining and regulating marriage is a matter of core state sovereignty under the 10th Amendment. And through this law, Congress has infringed.
Mr. Clement argues that Section 2, in fact, preserves the right of Massachusetts to define marriage as it chooses to do and ensures that there will be full faith and credit, that there is no interference here with Massachusetts' decisions. The question is rather whether Massachusetts' decision can drive the federal government's decision about its benefits programs, which it gives to employees, and tax consequences. So he views this as the sort of reverse of the way that you are articulating this.
I understand. What that view requires, though, is that for this court to depart from our nation's history in terms of federal acceptance of states' marriage, our jurisprudential history in terms of a recognition that domestic relations and marriage is an area of core state sovereignty, our congressional history, because if you look back to the Codd Affidavit at paragraph 19, you can see this is not the first time Congress has been here. Back in the earlier part of the 20th century, Congress actually contemplated a uniform marriage law, and they passed. They rejected it precisely because of the federalism concerns raised today. I understand the argument that they're making, that this is an argument about federal benefits and definitions and federal statutes, but that's a red herring because, of course, Congress can draft its laws and it can include the terms in its laws that it wants to include or not include. Ours is a different argument. Ours is simply that where Congress chooses to use marriage as a term in its statutes, it must do what it has always done and what it has to do under the 10th Amendment and accept a state marriage. There is no other type. Getting back to marriage as a matter of core state sovereignty, I think we understand why this is so. I mean, marriage determinations have varied across states over time because they're subject to issues of local concern, subject to judgments about region and geography. And that is why some states have allowed people to marry as early as age 12, and others made people wait until they're 18. But at every turn, despite at times great controversy, the federal government has always accepted, has always recognized a state marriage as valid for all purposes under law. And what we're asking is that this law be struck down as unconstitutional because we would like the federal government to return to what it has always done and recognize, respect our authority. Massachusetts wants to issue a marriage license. It's not only in the same form, but also has the same consequence for every married person in this state. That's what states get to do. That's been the division of power between states and the federal government since the time this country was founded. Indeed, it was the relationship between colonies and the English Parliament before that. And when the Constitution was drafted, the drafters didn't seek to arrogate defining and regulating marriage and give it to the federal sovereign. So we're just asking that this cooperative federalism be restored to its proper place. With respect to the comment about veterans statute, I find that ironic because actually that's an instance where in the 70s, as more women were starting to serve in the military, Congress changed the veterans statute to account for that fact. So that's why you see the change in terminology there. There were some other instances alluded to where Congress, or it appears that the federal government has not recognized a state marriage. And the Justice Department conceded that there are very few instances, but I want to be clear about what was happening there. In none of those instances was the federal government disregarding or not giving effect to a state marriage. What the federal government was doing was simply imposing some additional requirements that a married couple had to satisfy in order to qualify for a benefit. So if you take Social Security, for example, they've added this duration requirement because certainly Congress has a federal interest in making sure that its benefits flow to people who have been married long enough such that they've established a relationship of economic interdependence. So adding that addition, that requirement, makes sense. This is very different. This isn't an additional requirement that these same-sex couples can ever satisfy. They are out of the gate, out of the box from the outset. Because DOMA at bottom, maybe call the definitional statute, it's really a rule of exclusion. It's a rule of exclusion for same-sex marriages. I see I have little time left, and unless the court has questions, I'd like to turn to the equal protection analysis.
Yes.
Thank you. The Commonwealth believes that heightened scrutiny is the appropriate level of review here, and Cook does not necessarily preclude that for the reasons that heightened scrutiny and its factors were not briefed, argued, or decided in that case, nor was there a record upon which the court would have even been permitted to engage in that analysis. And it is idiosyncratic. It applied to the military context where there is no greater level of deference. And turning to let me say this, regardless of what level of scrutiny the court applies, we believe it fails. The arguments with respect to public fisc, I think, have been addressed. With respect to the public fisc argument, in particular, to me what I hear in Blagg's argument is that it would be just as permissible to cut gays from Social Security or not allow gay students to apply for federal loans. If Congress is allowed to draw a line that excludes people based on their sexual orientation with respect to marriage, I don't know how that's not extended to other areas. But whatever rational basis that was proffered by Congress at the time it passed the law, by Blagg on this appeal, by the Justice Department when they defended below, we believe they fail all levels of review. And the comments about Cleburne and Romer and Moreno are important because what was happening there is the court was considering the presence of animus or the presence of fear and prejudice and stereotyping in ruling that there really couldn't be a plausible basis for those laws. And we think that should guide the court's analysis here. Finally, I'd like to just end with the example of how DOMA requires Massachusetts to violate equal protection. And I'll take you to our state veteran cemeteries. Because here the operation of DOMA really revives the concept of separate but equal. Because in this day and age, where gay people can now go serve in the military, fight for our country, and even die, unlike other married service members, they can't be buried with their spouse on state land in our veteran cemetery. Instead, Massachusetts is essentially required to build on the next hillside over a cemetery for those veterans. We think that's wrong.
So thank you.
Thank you very much. We ask the court to affirm the district court's ruling. Thank you.
Mr. Clement, you reserve some time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd just like to make 4 points in rebuttal. First of all, the Justice Department essentially declined to answer the question of whether or not there are rational bases to support the statute. But, of course, there is, in the record in this case, a brief filed by the Justice Department earlier in the case that offered a number of rational bases. And it's certainly open to the President and the Attorney General to change their position and to say that heightened scrutiny should apply. But that doesn't make their prior submission go away, and it doesn't make the arguments in there about why there are perfectly rational bases, in addition to some of the ones we've covered in our brief, to support the statute. The second point I'd like to make is just a comment
on... Before you go further, can I just ask you something? If this statute defined marriage as not including marriages between different races, what would be the standard of review that we would apply to that?
I think you certainly would apply heightened scrutiny to that, Your Honor. But I actually wanted to talk about the interracial marriage situation because the plaintiffs make something of the
and
fact...
Why is that different in this case other than Cook, assuming Cook doesn't apply?
Well, Cook and the other reasons why heightened scrutiny would not be appropriate in this circumstance. But the interracial marriage example, I think, is an important one because the other side tries to draw something from the fact that Congress didn't do something to address the interracial marriage situation. But I think that the consequence, certainly of the state's argument, is that the federal government couldn't do anything to address the interracial marriage situation. And I think that is not correct as a matter of constitutional law. And I think it would be a very unfortunate consequence if they didn't have that authority. And indeed, I think Congress would have the authority, if they wanted to recognize same-sex marriages for federal law purposes, even in states that hadn't done so yet. And that's the authority that the federal government has to define marriage only for purposes of the federal code.
If but does that make any difference to the question that I asked? I take it back. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I interrupted you.
No, that's fine. I just have two more points to make in rebuttal. One is the plaintiffs make much of the point about this is a statute that can only be explained by animus. They liken it to the statute Romer. But there's one big difference, which is this statute, if you look at the way that it operates across various different federal programs, in some cases it's a net financial benefit to the same-sex couple. In some situations, it's a net financial negative for the same-sex couple. So to say that this is something unlike, and Romer, the statute there, of course, in every context worked against people, homosexuals. So in this situation, it's a much different statute, and it's only explained, I think, by the fact that Congress was trying to maintain this federal definition that had been the product of prior legislation in all of these other contexts. The last thing I would simply end with is that there is an alternative to constitutionalizing all of these issues. If you think about the gains that have been made on the same-sex marriage issue since the complaint was filed, since the district court's opinion, they have been remarkable. And I think that in some ways the ultimate question for this court is, do you want to constitutionalize this issue or leave it to the democratic process? Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I also have 4 brief points. The first relates to the original brief the government filed in this case. The second one superseded the first, and the bottom line in the first brief is no longer the position of the department. Second, on the Tenth Amendment argument, I think that the Commonwealth's argument is
very similar to the argument the state was making in South Dakota versus Dole, and in the way the court addressed this in framing that case, which we think of as mostly about the spending clause. But the state there was saying that the 21st Amendment gives states exclusive authority for same-sex relationships would be something fairly new. And certainly that is the case. But in Lawrence, a similar objection was made to the prospect of recognizing a protected area of freedom for intimate sexual activity between consenting couples, including same-sex couples. And near the end of its opinion in Lawrence, the Supreme Court said the following. In reference to the framers of the 5th and 14th Amendments, the court said, "They knew times can blind us to certain truths, and later generations can see that laws once thought necessary and proper, in fact, serve only to oppress. As the Constitution endures, persons in every generation can invoke its principles in their own search for greater freedom." Within the lifetimes of many people here, gay and lesbian members of our society have increasingly decided to live open and honest lives, including with respect to their personal relationships. They have, in Justice Kennedy's terms, invoked the Constitution's principles and laid a claim to full citizenship. Their government should take their claim to equal protection of the laws seriously and engage it on the merits. And the President and the Attorney General have done that in reaching their conclusion about the constitutionality of DOMA. We urge this Court to do the same and reach the same result. If there are no further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you. The Court would like to thank all counsel for really superb arguments in this case. We're very appreciative. We've learned a lot from you. We'll be in recess until the next case before the panel.
All rise.